IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. I am Saurabh Todi and I have with me my colleague Shambhavi Nayak. And we are going to discuss an exciting development last month where the Department of Biotechnology announced that they have completed the ambitious 10,000 genomes project. Now, again, this is an exciting project. We'll ask more about this to Shambhavi, what it is, why it is important, and what do we gain from it. So a very warm welcome, Shambhavi.
Thanks, Saurabh. And for a change, so happy that we are discussing something positive that has happened in the biotech space.
That's true. Like so many times you'll be like, okay, this is the problem, what to do. This is anxiety, but this is a very, very kind of exciting news.
So, proactive Shambhavi, step. Very, very positive, proactive step, I should add.
Yes, definitely. So Shambhavi, please explain, like, what exactly is this 10,000 genome project?
Right. So the 10,000 genome project started a while ago. The idea is obviously to sequence, as the name suggests, 10,000 Indian genomes. I think the project has sequenced a little over 10,000 genomes across multiple subpopulations of Indian citizens. What that means is not language or religion-based subpopulations, but actual genetic subpopulations. As we understand, in India, we are made up of caste and communities which have practiced endogamy for centuries. And what that means is that whoever was the founders of that particular caste or community, their genes have been conserved across the lineages as we have evolved, right? And so we have all of these genetic subpopulations, nearly 5,000 of them, across 28 states and 9 union territories. And we have always seen this idea that the Indian genome is not very well understood. If you don't understand the genome, then you don't know what kind of diseases we are at risk of, etc. And so this was, I think, the first attempt in a series of steps that the government wants to take to understand the Indian genome better, to understand how we can improve human health in India, for example. So it's quite exciting in that manner.
Yeah, I mean that's and this is like an extension of the 1,000 genome project, right? So So it seems like India is not unique in this. There are many countries, especially the US, Singapore, the UK, even China, who are doing these genetic sequencing of their populations as well. So why do this? You know, like why is it important or interesting to do something like this?
Okay, before I go to why I do it, I wanted to just briefly comment on the other countries which are also doing genomic sequencing. The scales are quite varied, right? Japan did one on 2,000 genomes, but they were looking at a very particular subset of diseases, the rare and undiagnosed diseases. UK did 100,000 people. Saudi Arabia did 100,000 people. The US did 100,000 people. So there seems to be a number which is much larger than the 10,000 genomes that India has started off with. And given India's population, I think we are going to also need to do a lot more screening and genome sequencing to be able to create a database of clinical importance. So that's just one point I wanted to make, that while this is a first step, when you compare it with other countries, India's genome data bank has to reflect India's population. So having said that, why are countries investing money into doing this? I mean, there's millions of dollars which is going into creating these databases. The databases inform us on the prevailing genomic landscape in the country. As I said, it tells you about people's health. As we make more and more strides in understanding the basis of biology, which is a genetic code, we know that there are diseases which are caused by a single mutation, thalassemia, for example, right? Diseases which have a genetic basis, cancer, for example. So you could have a BRCA1 mutation, which is associated with breast cancer, but and that increases your risk of getting breast cancer, but might not always cause breast cancer, right? And then there are genetic linkages to, say, diabetes and other lifestyle diseases. So a genetic map will basically allow us to understand whether a particular subpopulation is particularly susceptible to a certain form of disease or not, and then what kind of steps can be taken around that. It will help us understand the risk of disease burden in India, and then we can obviously take more constructive steps to alleviating that rather than waiting for the disease to come around and then try to medicate over that. One interesting incident where I think this idea became really solid, right, was there's a particular Vaishya community in Andhra Pradesh. And a couple of times when community members went to hospital for surgery, doctors found that they died post anesthesia, so they could not recover from anesthesia, which is strange. And they found that this particular community had a mutation where they could not produce the enzyme in the body that then breaks down the anesthetic. So once you're given an anesthesia, the body breaks down the chemical that is given, and that's how you recover. But they could not find that their body was not making this. And they found that this was a founder mutation, as in the founders of that community probably had that mutation. So it was present in a large population of this subgroup. That subgroup, I think, had practiced endogamy for 108 generations or something. And so this was pretty, the penetrance of this gene was pretty high. And eventually, doctors began asking people from that region when they came for surgery of what community they belong to. And if they said they belong to this community, then they chose to give a different anesthetic. Right? And this actually saved lives by doing nothing out of the normal per se, but just taking an informed decision on how to treat a patient. And this is what a better understanding of genetics can give us. It can give us the chance of making better informed decisions about how we live in a more healthy manner.
That's really quite exciting, right? I mean, we think about this very big things. Okay, we will, because of gene technology and gene editing, you know, we can do great things. We can create new organisms. But something as basic as ensuring that you now realize that a certain section of community or population may be at risk for a certain drug, or not being able to make an enzyme which is important, which we might think is useful, and then we see, right, there are so many subgroups of populations which are more at risk of, let's say, sickle cell anemia or thalassemia. So having a group level understanding of gene data, I think, would be a very useful thing to have. So now we see this, you know, idea of predictive genomics, right? What exactly is it? And would the sequencing of these genomes help in expanding the access to this field of predictive genomics?
So let me give you another example of how predictive genomics works, right? Certain Jewish communities are again very endogamous and have high prevalence of genetic diseases. This has been observed for many years, and there is a non-governmental organization called Dor Yeshurim, which kind of then started work on predictive genomics to a certain extent. So because the diseases were quite well understood, so for example, there's Tay-Sachs disease, which is a genetic disease, which is quite common to certain segments of Jewish populations. What Dor Yeshurim does is that it takes samples from Jewish boys and girls when they're in school. They are just given an identity number. So no name is taken, no other identifier is taken. They are given a number and a sample is taken, and they are not told, okay, what the result is, right? Because, so the way a lot of these diseases work is that if both the mother and the father have a diseased copy of the gene, the child has a higher chance of suffering from that disease, right? They are all recessive diseases that way. Most mutations are recessive diseases. What Dor Yeshurim does is it takes the samples, it doesn't give out the results. If the Jewish boy is going to marry another girl from the same community, then they both call into Dor Yeshurim with their respective numbers. And even then, Dor Yeshurim only tells them whether it's a match or not a match. So whether they have a higher chance of having a diseased child or not a diseased child. This basically tackle some of the pressing concerns that people now see with gene sequencing as well, which is, what about privacy? What about discrimination? So if we do this genetic panel, if I know as a Konkani, I am at higher risk of breast cancer, then, you know, will that scare me into doing things? Particularly if the link between BRCA1 and breast cancer is not that strong, the causality link. Second, will I be discriminated upon? Will people say that, oh, we don't want to hire somebody because they have a higher risk of a certain disease, right? So the Doreasharim system kind of bases on two principles, that genetic data cannot be discriminatory and all individuals have the right to not know. And once the couple then finds out that maybe they might have an increased chance of having a diseased child, they can do genetic counseling, etc. Right, IVFs, you can select for healthy embryos, etc. Right, so all of those become available. Very similarly in India, like you said, like sickle cell anemia is very common to certain, say, Adivasi groups. Right, what we can now do using predictive genomics is say that, okay, within your subpopulation, you are very susceptible to having this disease, right? Say thalassemia, for example. The treatment for thalassemia currently, before gene editing became available, was bone marrow transplant. And bone marrow transplant will cost you anywhere about 10 lakh rupees or beyond, depending on which care center and level of care that you opt for, right? And there's medications, etc., on top of that. Instead, if you knew that your community has a higher risk of being thalassemic, you could do a simple blood test, which would cost a few thousand rupees. And if you and your partner both have thalassemia, then you could go to a doctor and figure out what to do. And again, an IVF is much cheaper than a bone marrow transplant. And I mean, forget about the suffering that the child and the parents have to go through if a child with thalassemia is born, right? And so we can now actually be able to provide treatment and care at much lower costs. And then for a community, you can then create a panel of diseases, right? You can say that, okay, these are all the diseases that you might be at higher risk of. Please take care. And then you allow the individual to actually make an informed decision about how to go ahead.
Stay tuned to All Things Policy. We'll be right back after a short commercial break.
Yeah, that's quite fascinating. And I remember we were talking a few days ago regarding, you know, with this gene data collection, there are also many other issues, right? For example, the example of the Vaishya community you gave, that means that sometimes the caste group has to be linked with the data set. So although it may have a very important use to tackle diseases or risk factors, but there's also scope for, let's say, discrimination, right? So, for example, a DNA fingerprinting that we were talking about in office is that given that there is so much endogamy within caste groups, it would be useful to map genomes and then classify them according to caste groups as well, and which will then help, let's say, investigative agencies to figure out whether a DNA that is obtained from site, you know, like does match or not. So, I mean, can you like expand on this? And then how, in the case that you collect the data, and then although you have the right intention of classifying it by caste, would be helpful, but then also it may lead to discrimination.
So, the forensics, I think, is a little different from what we're doing here. So the idea in forensics is obviously that you get a sample from a site and you want to match it to a suspect. Now, if again the caste group is extremely endogamous, then two related individuals have a higher probability of sharing a genetic signature. The way the DNA fingerprinting works is not what you see on soap dramas and investigative serials online. It is not that you get a signature and you say that it belongs to this person, right? It's a probability game, right? We can say with certain probability that it matches a person. If two people are extremely closely related because of their genetic signatures, it decreases the probability with which you can say that this belongs to a certain person, right? And therefore, it is important that when you're doing forensic work in India, you again are cognizant of the fact that we have endogamous populations, right? The discrimination that might happen because of understanding that certain populations might be at risk of disease, right, is something that needs to be addressed. So the US, for example, has the GINA Act that prevents discrimination or prevents insurance claims from saying that because there was a genetic risk for a disease, that disease should fall out of an insurance claim, right? So those, I think we still have to reach a certain bit of maturity in terms of laws around genetic sequencing, data sharing, as well as the fallouts that will come because of that. And I think it is necessary that India acts on that now, especially if we are going to make this data also publicly available. Again, I do want to bring back to the point that this data set, as much as it is interesting and it is a good step, is a very small data pool. We need at least 1 million genome sequences for that data and sampled across these populations, right? So it is not like we will have 50,000 people coming from one population and only 5 from another subpopulation. So we need representative sampling for this data to be of any kind of clinical significance. But I think we can make adequate steps to ensure that discrimination doesn't happen. I think it will be unlikely also. I would be really interested to understand if health data generates that kind of interest within anybody except health insurance companies to act upon. But I would doubt it. Again, a lot of genetic data, apart from thalassemia, sickle cell anemia, etc., which are point mutations, there is only a risk of getting a disease. It doesn't cause disease per se. And so it will become, there will be a lot of confounding factors then. So I hope discrimination doesn't become a big risk of making gene data publicly available. I think the benefits there, especially of allowing people the choice of understanding their own communities better, their own self better, and taking proactive steps at improving their health is going to be much, much more. It will also allow the government, I think, to prioritize what diseases we would like to study, right? Because there might be we might think that something is a rare disease, but it might at that subpopulation level be extremely important. And therefore, that subpopulation might want to invest into studying that disease. So it will also help prioritize government efforts. One last thing I do want to talk about, because I think a lot of people get worried about data sharing, etc., is that if we don't do this, there is a lot of Indian diaspora abroad, which, you know, your cousins which share your genetic signatures, especially those from your founder members. And other countries will not be shy of gathering Indian data and, you know, trying to identify genes that cause disease, etc., and try to create medical products to treat them, right? So before an Indian foreign company comes and says, hey, if you belong to such and such subpopulation, you're more susceptible to this disease, here's our product, it is better that an Indian company does that.
No, I agree. And I think this is, you know, like one of those big challenges is that everybody is trying to sequence the genome of their populations to figure out stuff. But as you've said, that India needs to go much, much farther. And if smaller countries have sequenced about 1 million, I think India needs to have a lot more. So like I was reading the paper that you wrote with our colleague on, like, so what kind of a governance structure do you think it would need? So for example, now that you're sequencing that many genomes, let's say you have started by 1,000, now 10,000, maybe hopefully 1 million and more. So the biggest challenge then comes is how do you start sharing this data? So it might be useful to share it to, let's say, at least for research, both domestically and maybe globally as part of a bigger data set. So what are some problems linked with that? Or like, how do you think India should approach that?
Right. So I think this paper was written in 2019, I think. It was definitely written before COVID. And we had suggested that we have a National Genome Authority that kind of looks at the best trends, not only in sequencing, but also annotating this database and making the data publicly available. One of the things that we were very keen on is that the data is open, because then private companies and other players can come in and start creating therapeutic products as is necessary. And obviously, the data has to be anonymized and de-identified, etc. And again, the best standards of that is something that the genome editing authority can set up on, right? And then again, how do we manage international partnerships, etc.? There is this trade-off that is required between sharing data, because obviously even gene data in its entirety when shared can be used for malicious purposes. There was this report that the US was collecting all DNA of foreigners who visited the White House, so that they have a bank of all of these important DNAs hanging about in case they ever needed it. Obviously sharing DNA is a little bit different than sharing genetic data itself. But I think in an anonymized manner, sort of we all always talk about this, right? That this data, genetic data is only going to be useful when it's in large data sets, right? That's when you start seeing the patterns. And now that we have machine learning and AI and computing that allows us to look at these enormous, gigantic data sets. I mean, you and I were just looking at Indigen going, we can't meet head or tail of this. But there are others with capabilities who can do this faster, who can identify health threats faster. There has to be a purpose limitation. Obviously, we don't want data to be shared for reasons apart from research on health right now, right? Before we understand what else that data can be used for. So there are some of these protocols and code of conducts that need to be set, which is why we said that having a national genome authority would make sense.
No, that makes sense. I mean, obviously, with more and more countries doing this kind of research, the need to collaborate and cooperate increases. But then that has to be backed by a strong backing by the law and by having a institution that, you know, is independent and is able to do work without much. Because again, I think one of the greatest assets and prerequisites of something like this is public trust, right? The public should be able to feel that, okay, the data that I am providing is not going to be misused, is not going to be used against me in a manner which is unlawful or not allowed. So hopefully, I think as this technology is more and more, deepens more, its use cases increase, and countries realize that there is much more to gain from collaborating and than to just keeping it in their own biobanks and not sharing, I think we would be able to have a much better benefit from these technologies. And hopefully, when we talk next time on this, we will talk about a million genome sequence that would be announced. And hopefully, more than that, I think as India grows, as India seeks to establish itself as a major player in global bioeconomy, I think having this is an important aspect of that goal. Thanks a lot, Shambhavi. Always great to talk to you on these issues.
Thanks, Aurav. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in. Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them.
Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.